It is Saturday, May 4th, 2013. I'm broadcasting live from Santa Cruz on the central coast of California. This is KOSP Public Radio 88.9 and KOSP.org. It's time now for Geek Speak. Welcome to Geek Speak, bridging the gap between geeks and the rest of humanity. I'm your host, Lyle Troxell. Please keep in mind the views expressed during Geek Speak are not necessarily those of KOSP. On Geek Speak today, I'm taking your calls. So if you have questions or comments about technology, you're welcome to give me a call. Phone number is 1-800-655-5877. And I'll give out that information again when I invite your participation in about 15 minutes or so. Well, normally in this part of the show, I introduce my geeks and welcome them to join me on the show. But today I'm alone. Yeah, it's been 12 years of me doing this radio program. In fact, years ago, I grew up at the station. And years ago, I came in as a kid. And at some point, I started doing this program. I love doing it. Volunteer, of course. And for those people that listen to KOSP regularly, you know, I'm sure by this point that we've recently lost someone very important to the station who I've known pretty much all my life. And I just want to say that for Dale Owen, we're thinking of you. For the thousands of podcast listeners that listen to Geek Speak regularly, Dale Owen was a fixture for KOSP for many years and very well known for his classical expertise and his beautiful radio voice, and a generous man that I've known, like family. So, Dale, thank you for helping to make KOSP the wonderful station that it is. All right, so on KOSP, we might not talk about killer robots, but on Geek Speak, we always talk about killer robots. And specifically, recently, a wonderful report from Christopher Haynes. He's a South African professor of human rights law. He calls for a worldwide a moratorium on the testing, production, assembly, transfer, acquisition, deployment, and use of killer robots. Yeah, that's right. So we talk on Geek Speak a lot about robots kind of taking over the world, and it kind of uses a joke and everything. But this idea that there's militarized robots that can kill, there's a very big difference between an autonomous robot and a remote control robot. In some ways, the remote control, the idea of the human being at some degree is in control, is kind of creepy in the sense that they can be very remote from the danger and be killing people. But we've had that in war for thousands of years. I mean, archers are, remote from the danger, if you will. But in any case, Isaac Asimov's famous quote, or famous laws of robotics, a robot may not injure a human being or through inaction allow a human being to come to harm. It's in his 1942 story, Runaround. And of course, that story kind of has been made famous in science fiction more recently with this idea that if you do give that kind of command to a robot, it could potentially enslave the human race to protect it, right? It's a great idea behind it. But the study that Haynes calls for, he says, lethal autonomous robotics, or LARs for short, he says, decisions over life and death in armed conflict may require compassion and intuition. Humans, while they are fallible, at least might possess these qualities, whereas robots definitely do not. And I would agree. And of course, this is just a very succinct way of saying we should allow decision making of killing, not to some kind of algorithm. And as a computer programmer, I tend to believe that as well. I'm thinking no on the whole robots deciding who should die. It's creepy. It's very creepy. All right. In more kind of cool technology, the fastest ever plane. Now, this is a air-powered plane, or so the fuel was provided by air. So we've had fast flight for quite a while. We're always kind of pushing the limits. And in doing that, we learn a lot about aerodynamics. Recently, a Boeing plane, it's a 14-foot long, non-human, there's no human inside it. It went 5.1 Mach. Now, Mach speed, or supersonic speed, is the rate of travel of an object that exceeds the speed of sound in normal density air. Now, the speed of sound is going to vary depending on the density of the air pressure. But here in Santa Cruz, just right at the same level, sea level, here we have, in a dry day, if you will, the speed of sound is about 760 miles per hour, or as Boom would say, 343 meters per second. And that speed is extremely fast. And Mach, when you say Mach 2, would be two times that speed. So Mach 5 is really, really fast. The way the jet actually works, it's called a scramjet. And a scramjet is interesting in the sense that it only works at a supersonic speed. It works at extremely high velocity. And basically, the incoming air is compressed to a point of combustion with the fuel. So you get there is no moving part in the engine. It's just the shape of the rocket the jet that causes the air to compress down and then to expand as it burns with the fuel, as it oxidizes the fuel, and the reaction, you get lots of power. But to do that, you have to get up really high speed. So normally scramjets, you first initiate propulsion in some other way. In this situation, they used a solid-state rocket off of a plane. They dropped it, the rocket fires, and then the scramjet kicks in once it gets fast enough. And this thing went a long way for a long time, which is kind of cool. Very fast flight. All right. This is kind of an interesting story about what's online seems to be true. Like a lot of things we research on GeekSpeak, take a look at the Wikipedia article or kind of explore some story of a reporter, and then we take that as read. And to some degree, that's safe. But to some degree, of course, it's crazy. And I find that it's fascinating. As GeekSpeak's been around, we've talked about the emergence of Wikipedia. It didn't exist before the program. 12 years is a long time in the tech space. But there was a lot of debate early on with Wikipedia of whether that data would be valid and true and real. And this idea that the masses can produce more knowledge is really kind of an amazing idea. But it's also about the power of that centralized voice. We saw that last week in a wonderful story about how a Twitter account from the AP was hacked and how it caused that hacking, and then the incorrect reporting on the AP, the Associated Press's Twitter account, caused a dip in the NASDAQ for some, 3 minutes or something like that. And the report was fictitious about something happening in Washington. But in any case, the idea that that voice is very powerful, even though there's nothing but a social understanding of its importance. So when Google does something, for example, or Facebook does something, for example, we talk about it on the show because that impact is very effective of our world. And recently, Google declared something, kind of not declared in a public sense, but just changed an icon. It's a very simple idea. When you search on Google, you actually, depending on the area of the country or the planet that you're on, you'll get a different site. And they do that for different reasons. They'll do that for language suggestions, but they'll also do it just to have the search results be more bearing to you. So in the United States, it's .com. And in the Palestine area, it's .ps, I think. But in any case, recently, Google changed the Palestine. There was the Google logo, and underneath that, to the side, it was the Palestine territories. And on May 1st, they changed it from Palestine territories to Palestine. Now, that is actually a very controversial thing to do. Israel's effect and how the relationship works is very touchy. And Google's declaration has actually been met with a lot of critique, because what right does Google have to put an icon on their website? It's an interesting problem. It's not like they're saying anything is specifically a certain way. They just changed their labeling of their icon. Now, they're actually following a UN decision from October that named Palestine as a non-member observer state, which allows Palestine to join UN debates and, in theory, join global bodies such as the International Criminal Court and the like. So Google's to some degree following at least the UN's perspective. This is GeekSpeak. My name is Lyle Troxell. We are taking calls in the second half of the show, the second two-thirds of the show, pretty soon. The phone number is 800-655-5877. I'd like to get your calls in now so we can put you on air with your questions and comments about technology. I can ask anything. I can answer anything you'd ask. I'm not sure I'll be able to do it correctly, but you can test me. The phone number is 1-800-655-5877. Try to think of something that's not totally obscure, but I do like a challenge. You can talk about digital art and projectors and electronics and how to cut down a tree without hurting yourself. Computer programming, electronics, And social media, sure. JavaScript, I'm good at that. So a few things you can talk about. Theater, if you'd like. Do give us a call and give me a call to ask questions and comments about technology. Again, the phone number is 1-800-655-5877. Of course, if you're having computer problems or password issues, you can call as well. All right. We covered quite a while. We covered this story all the time. We're kind of interested in geek speak, being geeks, about 3D technologies and new construction material technologies. And 3D printers have been kind of hitting the stores lately. In fact, recently they're hitting consumer stores. You can go pick one up at a store, which is kind of amazing. But some of these 3D printers have some amazing capabilities. And the stories that we kind of seem to focus on that kind of creeps us out, I should say, is that you can construct weapons in your home, 3D printed weapons. Creepily so, I should say. So a while ago, someone printed a assault rifle. Now, they didn't really print the entire thing. They printed all the parts that were restricted to purchase and then bought replacement barrels and stuff, which you can buy without a license. So they're able to create a gun in their garage, if you will. So the story about the 3D printed gun is actually kind of more creepy now, because now this is the first entirely 3D printed gun. So you get a machine in your house and you get the plastics and you take a CAD file, that's a computer aided drafting file. Computer aided drafting? Sure. And you print the parts and then you assemble it and you have a fully functioning gun. The only piece that they needed that was not printed out of the ABS plastic from the machine, not the barrel, it was actually just a firing pin. And what they use for that is a nail. So go down to a hardware store, pick up a nail, pick up a whole bunch of ABS plastic, go home, print a gun. Now, clearly this is a little freaky, right? Because you can't regulate the creation of things in people's homes the way we traditionally do it. In traditional manufacturing, you need a giant facility to construct things. And therefore, the restrictive process is take a look at warehouses and construction and make sure that you're controlling that. And this is true in the reproduction of music. For a long time, vinyl records or CDs needed presses, and therefore they needed assembly lines, and therefore to reproduce CDs you needed structure and you could have governmental influence and you have the whole existing music industry. Along comes a new way of transferring information or transferring knowledge or construction of materials, and those ideas of restricting the creation, where the creation happens, just fails miserably. Now, the 3D printed gun that Cody Wilson calls the Liberator, which is a little creepy, I think, is a endeavor to make the complete gun printable by anybody that has a ABS printing 3D machine in their home or office, whatever, and that the CAD files, once it's complete, will go online, so you'll be able to download this thing. So the side effect of this, of course, is that anybody with a little bit of investment can be making guns. Now, another kind of creepy thing about this is that it is all plastic except for a little tiny metal nail. That means that now in the specs for this gun, this 3D printed gun, there is a specification to have a large piece of metal in there. And the reason for that is that U.S. laws mandate that a gun be detectable via a metal detector. So there has to be a certain amount of metal in it. And that's why actually guns that you can purchase are always detectable. It's been a long time we've been able to make firearms that aren't detectable metal detectors, but we mandate that the creation of them is restricted in that sense. So if you're printing it yourself, of course, you just don't need to put the metal in. And you have a gun that can go through a metal detector that you printed from your home that no one knows you have. And this, of course, has crazy ramifications, ramifications that I don't really think we have good solutions for. Of course, one of the ideas would just be, well, make more regulations to say it's illegal. But the point is, of course, that it doesn't matter if it's illegal because only criminals do things illegal with guns, right? Man, that's the whole idea, at least. Anyway, 3D printing technologies changing the world, of course. Every week on Geek Speak, we mention a geek bit, and that is something that you've got to see to believe. And this week, I'm going to mention velvetgeek.com. That's right, black velvet paintings for your inner nerd. This is that classical black velvet painting style with some awesome characters, Star Wars, Star Trek, and a whole bunch of other sci-fi. So I highly recommend velvetgeek.com. Let's go ahead and start taking some calls here on Geek Speak. Tony from San Jose, welcome to Geek Speak.
The Nook operating system from Barnes & Noble. I have the Nook HD tablet. It's a 7-inch tablet. It's very similar to Nexus 7, except it doesn't have GPS and a camera and stuff like that. And I really enjoyed it. But yesterday, I guess it was, Barnes & Noble rolled out a new upgrade to the operating system, and basically they changed the Nook system from a closed, curated app store to a wide open system, and now we have access to Google Play and all the 700,000 apps.
Sure.
And that sounds really good, but in the process of doing this update, they changed the browser from whatever the stock Nook browser was to Google Chrome Mobile version 26. And I really don't like it. And the stock browser was the stock Nook browser, and I don't know who made it, but it was great because it had a button called article view. And so when you were reading like a New York Times news article, it would reformat it, I guess using CSS, into a single column, double-spaced, big type. And for somebody who's 68 years old, like I am, it was great. In fact, it was essential.
Yeah.
But now I don't have that feature anymore. And I'm trying to figure out who made the old browser and how I could get it back. Or even if I could roll back the entire operating system upgrade to get back to my old Nook stock browser with the article view in it.
Well, I tend to... reverting back and trying to hold on to old technology is kind of like swimming backwards in a really powerful river. You might achieve it for a while, but eventually you're just going to be swept away with the technology. So I would recommend that instead of trying to go back to the Nook browser, which, by the way, might be completely possible, and I would assume that within another 24 hours you do some searches on this in Google, you'll find somebody that figured out how to do it. But I'm going to suggest instead just a really cool product that I use, which is called Instapaper. And Instapaper is an app that you install. And you would then have a bookmark that would install in Chrome. So the basic idea would be you'd go use the Chrome browser, which is a decent browser, and you'd step through the articles. And once you liked an article, you would click on this a bookmark. But the bookmark's actually JavaScript called a bookmarklet. And it would basically take the current URL and send it to your Instapaper account. Now, Instapaper is then going to grab a feed of that document, reformat it in this kind of way that's more readable than the existing website, and then save it in your Instapaper app and or the account. And then when you launch Instapaper, which I believe costs a little bit of money, you'll then have all these capabilities of changing the background color, changing the size, and kind of have that reading experience that you liked in the old Nook browser. Does that make sense?
Kind of. It sounds more complicated.
It is.
You said it costs money for this app?
I think it does. I think there is a bit of a fee for it. I'm not totally sure.
Okay, the old Nook browser had just a little button at the bottom and said "View article view." You tap on it, and the article was instantly reformatted. And, I mean, instantly.
Right.
And it included the graphics and everything. And, I mean, the simplest solution for me and a lot of people like that who depended on large type would be to be able to use that browser again as an alternative to Chrome. And I just wondered if you knew who made it and how we could get it. But.
Yeah, I don't know who made it. I'll definitely do some searching on it to find out. I would say that you're going to find a solution with the Chrome browser rather than reverting to the older browser. Chrome has abilities for doing things like this.
Okay.
So that's one thing I'd suggest instead of trying to find the old browser. One of the reasons is that it's very possible the old browser is just not going to be functional anymore. It's also possible the old browser was a skin on top of Firefox, or Chrome. Like, it's possible it was just that browser with some plugins. So to try to discover exactly what it was, I don't know enough. I don't have a Nook, so therefore I don't know. But I think that you're going to look for a new way of formatting in article view kind of way. I would recommend searching that.
Okay.
Okay?
Well, thank you very much.
Well, certainly.
I enjoy your show today, and I especially like the fact that there isn't a lot of... kind of like adolescent banter. I think you're much more focused today.
I do feel focused. I feel a little stressed, I have to say. It's hard not to have the background of people here to help out.
I think you're better.
Thanks so much.
Thank you.
Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
Well, let's go ahead and go to Felton. Marianne, welcome to GeekSpeak.
Oh, well, thank you very much. I'm hoping you're having a good time all by yourself. Oh, my.
Well, I'm not all by myself anymore, Marianne. Thank you for joining me. What's your question?
Well, on the radio. Hey, so my husband loaded Windows 8 onto one of our laptops. And
what did you move from? Did you have Windows 7 before or something earlier?
Oh, XP.
Okay. Probably a good move. Go on.
A good move, okay. Well,
maybe.
We'll see. Well, he forgot to do something with his emails, so he can't find any of them.
Hmm.
And he's not real happy, lost a few programs and things like that. But he was wondering if he could put, can he go back or go to 7 and...
get that stuff back?
Or if he goes back to... Huh?
Get that stuff back?
Yeah.
Let me help everyone else first, and then I'll help you.
Okay.
First off, I think I recommend at this point Windows 7. I think Windows 8 has some awesome, cool new things, but I think it's just not ready for prime time. Microsoft traditionally kind of skips an OS. They have a great one, they have a horrible one, they have a great one. And that's kind of a geeky joke that occurs. But Windows 8 happens to be one of the potentially bad ones. I wouldn't say it is bad. I think it's got some great potential, but I think Windows 7 is a really awesome operating system. So if you're migrating right now, go to Windows 7. There's no reason to move to 8. Okay, that doesn't help you at all, Marianne. Sorry. One next step is, depending on how your husband installed Windows, you are going to be great or you're not going to get that stuff back. And the reason is that there's different ways to install an operating system. You can wipe the machine completely, or you can kind of do for the default, which is to, quote, upgrade. And the idea is that the operating system will actually migrate stuff over for you. But I don't know if that takes place when you're upgrading from XP, which is a relatively old operating system, to Windows 8. I'm not sure if that path actually occurs in that way. The way geeks normally do it is, before they do the upgrade, they grab all their data and put it in a safe place. Then they wipe the, normally buy a new hard drive, install Windows, the new Windows on a new hard drive, then move stuff over. So you never have the potential of losing your data. Though it's more, if it's much more time consuming in the sense that you've got to kind of manually manage that process. And then the next thing I would recommend is that in most operating systems, there's a migration tool. And if you run the migration tool and the old content is on the machine, the migration tool might find it. Lastly, and so that's another suggestion I have. Definitely do that. Lastly, one of the things you want to think about with on a machine that doesn't have a lot of space, you won't be able to install the new operating system. There's not enough space unless you do what's called a clean install, and it erases everything. So it's possible it's all gone. Additionally, one last thing which will probably help other people and not you is that the way I recommend, thanks for being the guinea pig today, Marianne. The way I recommend doing email is a little different than what people traditionally run into doing. There are two ways to handle email. Three, let's say. There's this protocol called POP3, which is Post Office Protocol version 3. And that is actually the way that most people have set up their email. And this basically means you pop the email from the server where it got saved to your computer. If you check email in multiple locations and you have POP enabled, you only get the email at some places. When I say multiple locations, like if you have a laptop and a desktop, whoever checks the email first gets it. And that's kind of frustrating. But the other disadvantage of it is that when you get the email, it's no longer on the server. And if you install an operating system on that computer you got the email from, email's all gone. The other way to do it, the way I prefer, is what's called IMAP. And that's Internet Mail Exchange. No. Oh, man, I don't remember what it's called. IMAP basically allows you, protocol is the last part of the P, allows you to check email and interact with the server the entire time. You're not taking the copy from the server. You're not removing it from the server. You're keeping it there, which means if you erase your computer, totally format your hard drive, you connect to your email again, all your email's still there. The downside is that if you're wanted by the FBI or something, they can read your email by just talking to your server provider, even in the rears. So, Marianne, there's what I've got for you. I'm sorry that it's not more helpful. Definitely try Migration Assistant. It might be called something else in Windows 8.
Can you use that with CDs? Because he did do a full backup.
He did a backup? Oh, if he did a full backup to CDs, wow, that took some time. But what I would suggest, yes, when you do Migration Tool, you can target what the thing you want to migrate from, and you will just put in the first disk and say that, and it will actually ask through all the disks and look through all the stuff, and you'll get it back. He did the right thing. Let me see if it's called Windows 8 migration.
All right, because it's been a long 3 weeks.
Yes, I can imagine.
He's been like looking and searching, and I'm like, oh, this is getting old. Get off the sofa. Move on, you know? Okay, cool.
Yeah.
And I got my new computer, laptop. I got the Windows 8. Touchscreen, pretty cool.
Okay, so now if you're going to touchscreen, you have to have Windows 8. Absolutely, that's the reason. I was really talking about upgrading. When you upgrade an older machine, there's no real reason, but cool. Do you like it?
Yeah, I'm learning new things. I'm still trying to figure out where everything is. I got to put Chrome on it, though.
Yeah, the Chrome browser.
I don't think Firefox is as good on it.
Oh, well, Internet Explorer definitely is. As long as you're avoiding Internet Explorer, I'm kind of going back right now on whether Firefox can become my primary browser. And I've got some stories, if we ever get to them today, about Firefox. I'll see you at the next Mountain Community Theater production, and bring your tablet so we can play with it.
Okay, sounds good.
Take care, Marianne.
Okay.
Thanks for calling. You're listening to Geek Speak on 88.9 KUSP, also KUSP.org. If you want to know more about what we talk about on Geek Speak every week, for years I've been putting up articles and stories about the episodes we do on GeekSpeak.org, so please feel free to take a peek at that. From Las Gatas, Susan, welcome to Geek Speak.
Hi. I'm a publisher of a community magazine, and we are kind of merging print media with new technology, and that's not always an easy merge. So we have writers, local writers, graphic artists. We use a potpourri of tech. We use Quark for our graphic design, and we use a number of other...
You're still using Quark Express?
Yeah, because the demographics of my graphic artists and when they were trained, they're in Quark.
Okay.
And so that's what they're comfortable with. We have a monthly deadline, so we never really have time to raise our head and get trained on new technology.
Okay, you know what? I'm going to go ahead and ask you what the magazine is.
It's Out and About.
Out and About.
And we go from Los Gatos over to Santa Cruz and cover topics from theater.
Warning, music. Buzz marketing. Go on.
Anyway... theater writers submit everything via a Word document to us, and then we have court graphic artists and everything else. And I'm just wondering if there's software and cloud technology that we could possibly be using. Right now we're averaging about, 500 to 700 emails a month back and forth to get the magazine published, and I just have to think there's another better way to do it.
Yes, there is. Oh, my gosh. So are those emails sometimes PDFs made from the Quark documents back to the writers, or is it mostly just the content?
No, it's all how we have a production manager do it, and our production manager gathers all of the information from our writers.
Yeah.
We get photos. We get everything submitted that way. Then we put it into production. Then we get it laid out in Quark.
Okay, so what you're doing right now is relatively safe in the sense that no one else is in control of your business at some level. So when you start going to cloud, you start taking that risk of, well, there's a service provider providing something for me, and what do I do? There's a myriad of ways that you could upgrade the process flow. All of them involve some sort of training and work. There are products like Dropbox and Acelion, which allow you to specify folders on each other's computers that are shared, and as you put a document in there, everybody sees it. That's not so great
The problem with Dropbox that my graphic artist told me is that if somebody modifies it, the original document is gone.
Isn't that frustrating? Actually, there's history in Dropbox as well. It's definitely an issue. Also, you do not want to be in a situation where two people open the same document and start editing it and saving it, because who wins
that?
Yeah, it's
that's
not
right.
A mess.
That's what I'm concerned about.
So if you're mostly dealing with text, the other thing you could use is something like Google Docs, right? You make the document online. As you edit it, you can see it. You can actually turn on track changes. There's all that features of that capability. Yes, and if somebody edits it, it does get edited, though there is revert capabilities. We use Google Docs actually for GeekSpeak. Normally, in fact, right now, Rick's in the other room. He's taking calls from people, and I actually have a document in front of me. He can type, and as he types, I see it, and as I type, he sees it. It's kind of a cool way to live viewing. And there's a few tools out there that also do the same thing, which we've played with over the years, but the Google one's so easy right now because it's so ubiquitous, but we are required to have internet and Google playing friendly with us to do our show, right? It breaks down if we don't have that. So that's the risk you have to take.
So far, Google's been the most reliable.
Yep.
We do have a server for our website, and that some of our emails for one of our locations goes down, and we can lose email access. And so far, Google has been the most reliable, using our Gmail accounts and using our Google Docs and that kind of thing. It's just merging people into using Google Documents. And I had heard that there was a format that you could use through Google Docs where everybody can be working on something at the same time. And that
just a normal doc in Google Docs. When you open it up and you have two people doing it, you can start typing. It's pretty amazing. And you don't actually have to have an account with Google. It's the person that creates the document has to have an account. Everybody else can have a URL. And that URL is access to the content. I would highly recommend trying it out. But do keep in mind that the potential downside as well of that. Now, let me just jump back to Quark really quick. I used to do a lot of design work, and I did design work, traditional print design work in Quark. So I have quite a bit of experience with it. I stopped using it when I started doing a lot of web development, and all the design work that I was doing was online, and Quark doesn't help you with that. And then when I started stepping back in, because I always had Photoshop and Illustrator, I then started having InDesign, and I would recommend InDesign. It's an awesome program. I mean, I'm extremely impressed with it. And designers that have migrated from Quark over the years and now use InDesign swear by it. Unless they're stuck with Illustrator.
So I need it to be able to work in print media because we print a lot of magazines every month. But I also then, the way that we're, you'll probably die listening to this, but we then PDF all of our files and upload them for digital image on our website.
Yeah, that makes sense.
So,
so
InDesign helped me do both a little more efficiently?
Yeah, yeah. I mean, it's just a more advanced tool. Now, it's expensive, though. Adobe did just release this whole subscription-based feature, which is kind of cool, where you pay a monthly fee, and therefore you can try it out for a shortened period of time and see what you like, which is kind of nice. Also, I think all their apps you can download and try out. But it's going to be a learning curve. Moving from Quark into InDesign, you will be a little – it'll be a little different. It won't be as hard as most migrations because the layout concepts in InDesign are very similar to Quark. You know, you have text ranges. You can link text ranges, and therefore overflow goes to the next box and all that stuff that Quark was so excellent at. InDesign has that as well. But, okay, you know, if you're happy with Quark, why move, I guess?
Well, and it's more of a learning curve for the demographic of the people who are working on it. So I'm trying to merge it, but it takes a little while to be able to do that.
Absolutely. Susan, I would love to hear how you migrate your traditional business flow. I love the idea of how people actually do this. And I hear about new techs all the time. So do send us a note at geeks@geekspeak.org, and I'd love to see what goes on with you.
I will. And I love listening to you. Whenever I drive to Monterey on a Saturday morning, I'm all excited that I get to listen to you from Los Gatos to Monterey.
So well, thank you, Susan.
I'm happy that you're on. I will shoot you an email, and you can look at us, and we'd love to have you do our text column.
Oh, well, if I was a writer, I would jump on it. Thank you so much.
You don't need to be a writer. We'll make you a rock star. We have editors.
How exciting. I look forward to email. Enjoy the drive to Monterey, Susan. Bye-bye. If you'd like to listen to Geek Speak at any time, you're welcome to do so by going to geekspeak.org. A little NPR icon. You go over to the NPR feed, and we have hundreds of episodes of Geek Speak at your disposal at any time. This is Geek Speak. My name is Lyle Troxell. In the air with me is no one, but in the other room is Rick. And Rick will answer the phone and put you on air to join me with questions and comments about technology. Kieran, welcome back to Geek Speak from Santa Cruz. Kieran, hi.
Hi. I'm calling because I have an airport base station. It's the older one that kind of looks like half of an egg.
Yeah, the round one,
Yeah. My airport utility thing doesn't recognize it when I have it plugged in and broadcasting Wi-Fi, even when I'm connected to its Wi-Fi network.
Okay. So are you using an iOS management tool, or are you using a Macintosh management tool?
Mac. I think I'm running, let's see. Let me just look just a sec. My software version is 10.7.5.
Okay, so relatively recent one. So the issue is that you just can't you can't connect to it with the newer offerings, the newer airport utility.
Yeah, it doesn't recognize it. It's like there's no airports.
Right.
And
so
then,
I'm going to just put, let's see, I'm going to put up on the GeekSpeak website a little bit after the show the tech article that talks about all the different base stations and the software and firmware needed for each one of them and which OS, and you might be able to find the match. It's really just about the base station's versioning, the OS 10 version you have. And the last thing you've got to make sure is that sometimes you can turn off wireless editing rights to the base station so that you couldn't actually edit it through the wireless access. You have to be plugged in physically. That's in the older stations. The newer stations, I don't know if you have a setting. But I used to set them up that way to be more secure. So what you might need to do is take your Mac and actually plug in directly to one of those output ports and then manage that way. Make sure you're not connected to the WAN port. They connect you into the local area port, the LAN port. And for, you know, they
crazy icons. It only has three ports. One's a phone line, one's Ethernet, and one's power. It only has three ports.
So it could be, so you basically have to do it wirelessly, which means that most likely they don't have the setting that way. So do try to get I'll have the link up on the site.
I downloaded this thing and then when I try and open it, it's an airport configure.
Yeah.
And the icon for it looks like the router that I have.
Yeah.
You can't use this version of application airport admin utility for Graphite and Snow.app with this version of Mac OS X.
Okay, so that might be the problem. Do you have an old Mac around that has an older OS on it? That's the trick.
We have a blueberry clamshell MacBook.
That actually might, crazily enough, work. So try getting but that's probably a G4, so who knows if it'll have the airport utility on it. The other thing is there must be a way to manage these things without the airport utility, I'm assuming. Gosh. And I don't know enough about it to find out. But also try that out, because a lot of...
According to Apple's website, a disk came with them for managing that installed an application for managing them, and I tried to find... And I think what I downloaded was what that did.
Right. You just don't have the right operating system. So the other thing you could potentially do is boot off of an old operating system disk on your existing computer and then try to run... Yeah, it's going to be tricky to do, though. And then try to run the app from there.
We don't have any OS disks.
Yeah. You are in a bad shape, I'm sorry to say, Kieran. You might have to pick up a new piece of hardware or find somebody that has an older version of OS X and can come over with a laptop and configure it for you. And that would probably do it. All right? Thank you. Thank you for the call.
I also have another question.
I think I'm going to move on with the next person, but I'd be happy to get an email from you.
Okay, I'll email you the question.
Sounds good. Geeks at geekspeak.org. Cool. Bye-bye, Kieran. Well, so Margaret in Culver City, welcome to Geekspeak.
Hi, thanks for taking my call.
Certainly, my pleasure. What's your question?
So I'm PC ignorant, but I own a Mac, but there's a nonprofit organization in Santa Clara that has done a lot of help for my family, and I asked them if there was something I could help them with, and they really want a new PC computer, so I want to buy it for them, but I'm not really sure what to buy.
What's the organization? What's the nonprofit?
Oh, it's called JW House, and it's a nonprofit house that if you have a sick family member and you come from out of town, they will let you stay there.
Oh, nice.
You can, you don't have to spend $1 billion on a hotel.
Right. So are they looking for a laptop or a desktop machine?
A desktop, and the main use would be for other people who are staying there while they're under the stress of loved ones in the hospital. And
sure.
So what they told me they want is something that could access internet, so people could email family. They could also print boarding passes.
I'm actually going to suggest, instead of going to buy a new computer, because for this type of purposes there are a lot of people getting rid of computers that completely can facilitate this. And where I would go is actually another nonprofit in the area here called Gray Bears, and that's graybears.org. And it's basically, and they actually refurbish computers and resell them. It's part of the donation process and such. So you can actually go to them and say, I want to get a computer and this is what I'm using it for. And you'll probably run into staff that will really help out making that transition. And they might, give a good deal and all that because it's going to another nonprofit.
Oh, that's a great idea.
All right, cool. Okay. So graybears.org. Thank you, Margaret, for the call.
Perfect. Thanks, Lyle.
Take care.
Bye.
Bye-bye. You're listening to GeekSpeak. I am taking calls with questions and comments about technology. You can call and ask me anything you'd like. The phone number is 1-800-655-5877. From Pacific Grove, Rich, welcome to GeekSpeak.
Hey, thanks for taking my call.
Certainly.
Basically, I was a PC guy for a really long time and then switched to Mac a few years back. I do a lot of web and video production. And for the longest time when I was on PCs, I got really used to doing the defragmentation every couple of weeks just to keep things running at optimum performance. And I kind of researched a little bit on the web and gotten conflicting opinions whether or not something like that actually is needed on a Mac. And just kind of wanted some info on that.
Traditionally, in OS X, you do not need to defrag your hard drive. Now, fragmentation, let me just explain to everybody what it is. You obviously know what it is because you've seen those pretty little Windows icons moving things around. But a hard drive is a collection of ones and zeros on a rotating disk. And every bit of file that you write has certain size, and therefore it takes up a certain amount of physical space on the disk. And as you write and read and erase and move things around on your machine, you actually get holes in the spacing of the drive. Not physically in the spacing, but there'll be space that's not being used on the hard drive that's called fragmentation. The other concept of this, if you have a really large file, let's say it's a terabyte file, and you try to write on a disk, you're actually going to break it up into multiple bits, and that is going to cause it to be slower to read and write. Now, more contemporary operating systems just don't have this problem because they're doing things that are making sure that they don't defragment the hard drive as much. So it's one of those things you basically don't have to worry about anymore. But in OS X, you really don't have to worry about it because it's designed to be that way. What I would recommend, though, is leave the machine on overnight about once a month. And the reason is that it does have tasks that it does on the machine. And you can actually force some of these tasks to run. At least that's, I don't even know if the most recent OS does this. But that's the older way to do that is it would actually have weekly tasks that would run to move files around to fix this problem. So the short answer is don't worry about it. The longer answer, if you want to be, you know, have fun with it, you can go ahead and defragment your drive. SSDs just don't really need defragmentation. It's a different way that they work, mostly because they don't get slower with the stuff being spread around as much, right? So they don't physically have a path they have to run. Hard drives are a lot more complicated than we actually think they are. There's a lot of smarts inside a drive. And so when you start trying to help, sometimes you're not helping. I think the best suggestion I have for hard drive maintenance is a product called SpinRite by GRC.com. It's an awesome application that works by basically reading and writing all the content on the drive and helping the drive figure out what potential problems exist. And you can actually do a lot of recovery with it as well. SpinRite's a really cool app. But I would say that would achieve the concerns you have of, you know, doing something, because you want to do something with your hard drive, right? It's no fun to just let it work. The other thing you could do with your hard drive is regularly replace it, just assuming that it needs a new one every once in a while. But, you know, that's a truism about hard drives as well, that they will fail. So does that answer your question? Don't have to worry about it in OS X?
Yeah, that I think that about sums it up.
It's not so exciting, though, right?
Yeah, it's not that exciting. I like to be able to tweak stuff when I can, but I heard somewhere that the Mac OS software writes and reads differently than traditional PC software, and that was part of the reason it didn't need it. But yeah,
that's the general way of talking about it. Yeah, the other thing that I want to mention to you, though. I mentioned SpinRite. Actually, you can't run SpinRite on a Macintosh BIOS. So to do it on a Mac is a little difficult. You actually have to have another machine and mount the drive as an external drive. It's kind of a mess to do. But in any case, there you go. Sorry, there's not
Sounds
more
good.
To do, Rich. Good luck. And welcome to the Mac movement. Sorry that you've left Windows. I'm sure Windows is sad.
Yeah, I eventually saw the light.
Let me ask you, how has it felt?
It's just, I really enjoyed in the past kind of building my own PCs and getting them to run. I'm, you know, tweaking them out and getting them to run as fast as possible. But, they're kind of like hot rods. They're fun and they're fast, but you constantly got to tinker with them. And I got to the point where I needed to get more work done and,
You didn't want to tinker anymore.
Yeah, exactly.
Right. Well, thanks for the call.
Alrighty.
Take care.
Thanks a lot.
If you'd like to call in with questions and comments about technology, the phone number is 1-800-655-5877. Again, that's 1-800-655-5877. It wouldn't be a Geek Speak episode unless I talked about Facebook. That's just a rule now. So I'll just mention really quick. A while ago, Facebook launched a thing called Timelines. And this idea, it's just the way a person's website on Facebook looks, or web page on Facebook looks. It's that timeline of their life and their experience on Facebook. And if you get into Facebook and you start seeing it, you kind of start wanting to fill it out more and like get baby pictures of yourself and stuff. Careful. They're winning. But in any case, Timelines was actually a trademark of somebody else, some other company. And recently, quietly, Facebook had to settle the lawsuit. And though it's not claiming how much it actually gave to, I think it's, I can't remember who, it's RIM's involved, Summit 6 is involved, it doesn't matter who's involved it to some degree. But what I was going to say that they settled the court, they didn't talk about how much it actually cost them, but clearly it's in that millions of dollars area. So someone made some money off of Facebook choosing the term Timelines. That's kind of cool. All right, browser update news. My day job is dealing with JavaScript, and so I pay attention a lot to the browsers. I'm part of the W3C working group for web apps, so I actually have a lot of discussion about how browsers are functioning and stuff. And recently a new kind of cool thing hit the web space, if you will, of Mozilla teaming up with OTOY. Odeo, I don't know how to pronounce it, but to bring plug-in-free video playback on your machine. Right now, when you go up to YouTube or you go up to Netflix or one of these services and watch video, you a lot of the times you're using a proprietary codec, a video encoding format. And Flash was the way to play videos. Now we have HTML5. But still, the codec to render back, the playing back of that video, has traditionally been this other piece of software that the browser uses. And that H.264 has been the codec that's been most common. Apple kind of supported it. It's an open standard. But it does take some non-native parts of the browser, basically code that's the browser uses that's not something the browser actually wrote. Mozilla, a nonprofit organization, is very keen to do open source technology all the time. So they have teamed up with OTOY to make a new codec called ORBX.js. And for those programmers out there, you know that .js stands for JavaScript, which means this is a JavaScript library. It runs in the JavaScript runtime, and you can play quality video using just the JavaScript runtime. I'm not surprised this is happening, and I kind of like the idea that a new codec is born that's open source, because you then can let go of some of these costs that are associated with video playback. Every time these browsers, all the five major browsers, want to include the HT64 codec in their browser, what that means is they have to pay a little bit of money to that consortium, that group. Now, these browsers actually have a lot of money in that space to some degree, but that just the idea that in order for them to release a piece of software, they have to pay money to a third party to do features that we all require and like, it's nice to see that there's an alternative. And that's available now in Firefox, the most recent build, which is pretty cool. Another Firefox success story is about MathML. Now, MathML is a... Well, let me just read... MathML's Wikipedia paragraph. Mathematical markup language is an application of XML for describing mathematical notation and capturing both its structure and content. It aims at integrating mathematical formula into the World Wide Web, pages, and other documents. It is a recommendation of the W3C Math Working Group and part of the HTML5 standard. The basic concept is this. You've all seen a textbook, a math textbook, or gone through high school math, college math, and had to deal with equations that are pretty complex. And when you see one of those equations on paper and you write them down, you can do it because we're really flexible human beings. But when you try to type that into a computer screen, you have a lot of trouble. It's actually quite difficult to do, especially sharing it in a web browser. You'll notice that in most applications that deal with writing equations and such, they have the capabilities of doing complex equations. And I'm talking about all the different Greek letters, but I'm also talking about the fractions and actually denoting complex equations using all the mathematical symbols that mathematicians use. So MathML is a way of saying, okay, here is the structured way of declaring mathematical objects or mathematical equations, and a browser that supports MathML would allow you to see that in the browser, which is awesome. And MathML has been a standard for a while, and W3C has recommended it, the browser is supporting it. Recently, Firefox has passed what's called the ACID-2 test. Now, in the ACID-2 concept is basically that you are rendering what is expected to render. So basically, you build out a test suite on a web page, and you say, well, the general concept would be, put all the equations you could possibly write, put them on a web page, and then does Firefox do it correctly? Does Chrome do it correctly? And load them all. Firefox recently passed that set of tests to say, yes, you can actually use the full suite of MathML language in Firefox browser. And of course, everybody else is going to have to step up to the game and get that to work, which is awesome. Another JavaScript-related news story is that the Turbolens HTML5 game engine is now an open source project. Now, when we talk about open source, what we're talking about is the software to do the project being available to view. If you're really interested in that topic, you can look at the Stallman episode of GeekSpeak. We talked a lot about what open source and free lunch, that kind of concepts of free and open source technology actually means. In this situation, one of the more open of the open standards, if you will, the licensing agreements, is the MIT open source license. And that basically says, here is the code and do anything you want with it. So a new game engine is available now. And you can learn everything I talked about today on GeekSpeak by going to geekspeak.org. I'll add links and comments and all that. Please feel free to do that. GeekSpeak is a registered service mark of Online Tonight with David Lawrence. He's used with permission. Thanks to Rick for being here in the air room with me today. My name is Lyle Troxell. We're here every week at 10 a.m. on KUSP Public Radio. Did you like the show today? Do you like what you saw, what you heard? You want to have more questions? Please do visit us online. You can follow us on Twitter and Facebook and Google+. And, of course, we're up at geekspeak.org. I'll see you next week. Stay tuned.